This episode of Dear Hank and John is brought to you by Blue Land. Did you know that about 5 billion, billion? That's I checked that because that's a lot. Plastic hand soap and cleaning bottles are thrown away every year. And if that's not bad enough, most cleaning formulas are 90% water, which is heavy. We're shipping around all this water using fuel when we don't have to. Every year, Americans throw away 25% more trash from Thanksgiving to New Year. This year, maybe turn the New Year's resolution into action that makes a difference by switching to Blue Land. Blue Land is on a mission to eliminate single-use plastic by reinventing cleaning essentials to be better for you and the planet with the same powerful clean you're used to. It's a simple idea. They have refillable cleaning products. They have a nice design. I have them in my home. It looks nice on your counter. You fill the reusable bottles with water, drop in the Blue Land tablets, wait for them to dissolve, and you never have to grab bulky, heavy cleaning supplies on your grocery run ever again. And refills, because they're small and you don't have to ship a bunch of water across the country, starts at just $2.25. You can even set up a subscription or buy in bulk for additional savings. From cleaning sprays to hand soap, toilet bowl cleaner, and laundry tablets, everybody, you know what I mean. All Blue Land products are made with clean ingredients that you can feel good about. Blue Land is trusted in over a million homes, including, yeah, mine. Blue Land has a special offer for listeners. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/dearhank. You won't want to miss it. blueland.com/dearhank for 15% off. Again, blueland.com/dearhank to get 15% off. Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a comedy podcast about death, where two guys, Hank and John Green, who are brothers, we answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. Hey, John, how are you?
Well, Hank, I'm just back from a long bike ride, and I seem to have injured myself in the seat area, I would say, broadly speaking, the sort of... I guess if it were up in my privates, if you will.
I like the idea that the seat is a part of the body that is the part of the body that sits on the seat. So you put your seat on the seat.
And the whole, everything that touches the seat is the seat. That is my theory. And that whole part hurts. So I'm just trying to not focus on it too much. Hank.
What?
Do you remember in our last episode, or maybe a couple episodes ago, I don't know when it happened. Uh-oh. Do you remember that you said that you were going to burn all the copies of a book?
Oh, God.
Because it talked about how pythons lay eggs. Yep. And of course, you knew
we're
that pythons
start with this.
Didn't
okay.
lay eggs because they gave live birth. Well, Hank, we got, really for the first time, corrections to a mistake you made. It's so rare on Dear Hank and John. I'm just going to highlight one out of many because it turns out you could have just Googled this. There's tons of pictures of it. This one comes from Ishmael, who writes, Dear John and Hank, I could not help but notice a glaring error near the beginning of the latest episode. Yeah. Approximately 2 minutes into the episode, Hank describes a passage from a children's book that mentions a mother python and her hatchling. And Hank says, pythons give live birth and don't have hatchlings. That's incorrect. Oh, pythons do indeed lay eggs. It's almost like Hank should trust what's in books instead of what's in his mind. That wasn't from Ishmael. That was from me.
It's true. Boas give live birth.
Okay, well, that's not an... Pythons. We weren't talking about boas.
I know. I'm aware. It's just I'm explaining how I got confused.
All right. Well, I am delighted. I am absolutely delighted by this situation.
No, I bet. I mean, frankly, the only reason it hurts so bad is that I spent so much time whining about it.
Oh, yeah. I know.
So just never whine, I guess, is the solution to that problem.
Yeah.
Thanks for starting with that, John.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Did you not have a poem?
Oh, I do. I have one. It's a haiku by Kobayashi Isa.
Okay. Hit me.
Everything I touch with tenderness, alas, pricks like a bramble.
Dang.
Now, it's hard out there. It's hard out there for a Kobayashi Isa and other haiku writers. A lot of suffering.
Man, yeah.
A lot of disappointment when you try for the tender touches, Hank. Sometimes you find that it just comes with a bramble.
Yeah, I tried to tenderly touch Python, live birth Python babies, but it just hit that hard eggshell. That's my poem for the day.
Hank, I'm really excited to get to the questions from our listeners. We got some great questions this week. This is my favorite one.
Okay.
So can we start there?
Mm-hmm.
All right. We've also got some great sign-offs this week, some great name-specific sign-offs. This question comes from April, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I deliver babies for a living. Oh. And as you probably know from experience, human babies are wonderful and amazing, but not always cute. This is especially true in the beginning when they're purple and wrinkly. I know it gets better, but sometimes new parents are a little shocked by their offspring's appearance. My Dutch mom has a saying for this problem, which basically translates as, ugly in the cradle, but pretty at the table. Is there some catchy phrase like this in English that I can use with new parents? Showers and the cruelest month, April."
Oh, good sign off. Okay, first of all, when you say I deliver babies for a living, that really sounds like you put them in a truck and FedEx them around town.
Well, that
town.
Is my assumption. How else would you deliver them?
You're delivering them to someone, from somewhere to something. It's really right. You deliver a baby from one end of a person to the other end is the most of the delivering that happens.
I mean, my kids listen to this podcast. I'd like you to be as vague as possible.
Okay. That's it. That's the sitch. John, were you surprised by the way that your baby looked when it was first...
I mean, look, Hank, this is a podcast that's going to be publicly listened to, but also that potentially my own children will one day hear.
Right.
So they were both beautiful and amazing, and they looked like actual gods. They looked like tiny cherubs. They looked like they'd been painted by Michelangelo. I was astonished by their beauty.
Okay. Samesies. But with like a cherub painted by Michelangelo, except with the head of an almond. It's just...
Oh, man. I'm sure Michelangelo never painted a cherub, and I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for that.
I definitely didn't have any of the people. There were lots of lovely people around. None of them said to me, don't worry, he'll look better tomorrow. And I don't think you should say that because then you're saying, then you're saying, like, so just so you know, I'm aware of how ugly this thing is. You don't want to say that. Maybe they aren't thinking that their baby is super ugly. But if they do look to be in distress, if they're asking questions like, is it supposed to look like that? Give them some security in the fact that their baby is normal. But, you know, and sometimes they're not pretty at the table. Let's be honest.
I think the first words that every baby should hear upon birth are ugly at the cradle, but pretty at the table. after someone's gone through all of that effort to give birth, I think it's really good if the very first thing that you hear about your baby is the word ugly.
Ooh, whoa, wow, oof.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You just give reassurance. So if people are like, is my baby ugly? You can just be like, no, it looks like a regular baby. You could just say what Hank said the first time he met his nephew Henry. Well, it's a baby.
Yep, that's what that is. This next question comes from Jamie, and we need to get to it. So I'm going to have it be the second question because I got this thing that I'm shaking at my microphone right now because I was so entranced by this question and by my inability to have had it previously. Jamie asks, "Dear Hank and John, I come to you with an urgent matter. I can't sleep at night without knowing how are hot dog buns pre-cut if they're stuck together in the package?" So we went and bought some hot dog buns, John.
Yeah.
And I haven't opened them. And I had never thought about this, but it's true. So they clearly, like there's a machine that just like lays out the buns like four at a time, but they when they get cooked, they bake together so that they're, like, this isn't the case for every hot dog bun, but if you get the cheap ones, it's like this. So that they bake together and they're all stuck together and you have to pull them apart. But when you pull them apart, here's what I've noticed. I've got the four in my hand. The two on the outside are cut on the outside. So it's clear how that happened. The blade just went into the outside two buns. So I'm gonna tear those two off because like that is obvious how that occurred, and then I've torn that off, and now we've got okay, and that one. Now we've got these two ones on the inside, which are both
of their, now that the outside buns are gone, the outsides are both the sealed sides. So what we have is in the middle, and I'm sticking my finger in them right now, they have been cut by a single blade that went right down the middle of the four hot dog buns, but was not quite the width of the two hot dog buns. So that blade went in the hot dog bun butts and out the hot dog bun mouths. And then if you open them, you see that this this slice has gone through both of them, and all the way through. So it goes all the way through. It's not just like sliced on the inside. It's like the butt sliced too. So the blade comes in through the middle of the hot dog buns, and then you get four pre-sliced buns. And this one, actually, you can tell that the blade went way further through one of the buns than the other one, because this one is almost just two pieces of bread, and this one is really secured together. And now I have lots of hot dog bun crumbs on my desk. So,
well, Hank, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you answering this question in the form of a podcast where we can't see any of the things that you're talking about.
Well, you know what a hot dog bun really butt is.
It really adds to the experience.
You know the situation. Like, you're not confused by what a hot dog bun butt is. I'm not confused by what your seat is. We're all on the same page.
You know what? Our listeners are a lot smarter than I am. Hopefully they'll be able to follow what you just said.
I'll post a diagram on the Patreon.
All right, we'll post a diagram on the Patreon. Hank's going to work up an infographic to help you out there. That's patreon.com/dearHankandJohn. We got another question. It comes from Caroline, who asks, "Dear Green Brothers, what is the proper response to being constantly serenaded?" Mm-hmm. "See, many members of various musical acts have written a song prominently featuring my name, including the Beach Boys, Outkast, Fleetwood Mac, Brooks and Dunn, Chicago, and of course, Neil Diamond. While I love my name, I've come to expect a specific reaction to it. Is there an optimal facial or verbal response? Like, frequently those serenading me act like they are the first to ever think of this idea, while two, they struggle through the lyrics," which of course, Caroline has memorized. "I don't mind so much when my good friends burst into Neil Diamond upon each side of me. I would mind the hell out of that.
Yes,
but when
would.
The random store clerk hears your name and breaks into song like it's the eighth inning at Boston's Fenway Park, what's a person to do? Sweet, comma, Caroline." Great sign off.
Good sign. Yep. First of all, I want to say that last night, laying in bed, I Googled that indeed, it's not
touching hands.
It's, oh God, please stop.
Reaching out.
Like, not only is it you singing, which you said you wouldn't do anymore, but it's you singing
you,
this song.
Sweet Caroline.
Don't do it. No.
I'm sorry. What was the question?
Oh my God. Catherine hates the bop-bop-bas so much. She hates them so much.
I mean, to me, it's not even Sweet Caroline without the bop-bop-bas.
It's just like, don't bop-bop-ba. There's horns. They're doing it. And why does everybody say so good? That's not even in the song.
It's so good. It's because the song is so good. I'm sorry. What were we talking about? What was your answer?
I was saying that I spent a little time and I Googled that indeed, like, I didn't know Outkast had a song about Caroline or that Brooks and Dunn did. I didn't even know what Brooks and Dunn was. But there's a lot of songs about Carolines, and that is a kind of blessing. But my guess is that all you hear is Sweet Caroline. You know, I hear people like burst out into Outkast, and if you did, you'd probably be like, oh, thank the Lord for not singing Sweet Caroline right now. A little bit of variety in my life is fantastic. But there's something I think in particular about Caroline where you immediately, that song stuck in your head because it's somehow become so ingrained in culture, thanks, I think, largely to Red Sox fans. But
no. No, it's before Red Sox fans.
I don't know,
Hank, I just want to point something out real quickly, which is that Caroline doesn't even mention the best song about her name.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is the Old Crow Medicine Show song, Caroline, which Sarah and I almost had as our first dance at our wedding until we realized that it is about a brother and a sister. But it is a great song. It is worth looking up. Caroline by Old Crow Medicine Show. A total winner for your name. I do think that this would be difficult. Most blessings, Hank, are complicated blessings. And being named Caroline is certainly one of them. I think that I would just... when it was a store clerk or something, I think I would just say, you know what? I'm familiar with that bit.
Nope. Deeply disagree. Because you don't want to make some stranger like have a less good day.
Oh,
just because like, then, like gonna, then they're going to be like, oh yeah, I'm a freaking idiot and I should never talk to people ever.
So you're one of these people who thinks like, don't educate the world one at a time. Just suffer a little bit every day.
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess if you're going to the same store over and over again, like just stop and they like they serenade you every time. Stop going there. But yeah, maybe just have a different name sometimes. I guess you got to give them your ID.
Oh my God, that's a great idea.
And then they look at your ID and they're like, ah, oh, sweet Caroline. Hey, girly. Bah,
no,
bah,
no,
bah.
No. No, you just go. No, you, when people look at your ID, they're going to see like Caroline, whatever your middle name is, Debussy.
Yeah.
I bet that's Caroline's last name. And you could just be like, no, I go by Dubs.
I go by Dubs.
Because that's how you shorten Debussy, I believe. I believe that's how the original Debussys did it. That's how they started going by Dubs. So I would just, that's what I would do, Caroline. I would just, like, when you're asked, you know, what's your name at Starbucks, just be like, it's Dubs.
Yeah, or you can have like a, like, no, here's the idea. You have a button and then it says, I serenaded sweet Caroline. And then every time somebody does it, you just give them a button. That way,
that's a great idea.
Not only is it fun for all, but it costs you extra money.
Hank, that's the best idea so far. Keep a bunch of buttons that say, I serenaded Caroline Debussy with sweet Caroline. And then maybe have a couple that for the Outcast song, just in case.
just in case. Just for roses. Oh, gosh. There's a lot of... It's not even that particularly that good of a rhyme. I don't know why Caroline is such a great, great song to...
I think the last syllable hits so hard and it feels like... The last syllable of Caroline has always felt like a celebration to me. I've always been predisposed to Carolines, by the way, as you know, Hank. There is something about that name that has always rather captured me in the way that the name Catherine captured Colin Singleton in my second novel. This question comes from Brandon, who writes, Dear John and Hank, so a friend of mine recently got his driver's license, and he's a great driver, except for one thing. He's always nervous making left turns. Do you remember that, Hank?
Yeah.
It was terrifying when you first started out.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, how far can you get making only right turns? Curious friend, Brandon.
John, do you know that UPS takes 90% left turns?
I only wanted to read this question so I could share that UPS fact.
Yeah, in 2012, they just stopped making left turns. They were like, we're done with that. That's too much work.
Well, they figured out that it was more fuel efficient to make three right turns, not every time, but most of the time, than it is to make one left turn. And so in certain big city situations, the GPS just says to make three right turns. So I, Brandon, think that that's no problem. I have no issue if your buddy wants to treat the world like a UPS driver and just do three rights instead of one left.
Just go around and big. Well, they also like you. Nice thing about being a UPS driver is like you got software that's planning your route for you. So you got to go everywhere anyway. So there's got to be a way to get there by making a bunch of right turns. But they do make left turns sometimes. But 90% of the turns they make are right turns.
My longtime mentor, Eileen Cooper, who, you know, is not a young person and has probably been driving for, I don't know, I'm going to say 30 years so she doesn't get mad at me. Eileen has like never makes a left turn. She has a strict policy that if she's going to have to make a left turn in a drive, then she's just going to take the train. So your friend is not alone. UPS drivers and Eileen agree. Right turns are the way forward.
Practice makes perfect, John. This next question comes from Valerie, who asks, Dear Hank and John, earlier this year, I got accepted to my first choice university program at the far... As the fart of the start of the fall, as the start of the fall semester gets nearer, I think that I'm going to start getting cold feet. So I guess my question is it normal to feel extremely unqualified going into university? I know that I got into the program and that I earned my place in the program, but I can't shake this feeling. Hiding in the freezer to avoid summer melt, Valerie.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, Valerie, I think that feeling may accompany you through the rest of your life.
Yeah, just get used to this one.
It has accompanied me through my entire life, where I have always felt like a complete imposter, and like I just don't, I am not qualified to be doing the things that I'm doing, and that at any moment the world is going to figure that out, and the public shame that will befall me will be unlike anything that any human has ever experienced.
Wow. That's well, hopefully it's not that bad, but John has a gift for hyperbole, but also for anxiety. So who knows which one it is?
It's true. A little bit of both, my guess. Remember that woman who made the extremely inappropriate tweet about HIV infection in sub-Saharan Africa right before getting on an airplane, and by the time she landed, she'd been fired from her job, and her husband had divorced her, and all of her children had disowned her, and she was a pariah on the social internet?
Yeah.
I think about that every time I write a tweet. And then I remind myself, okay, well, but this tweet isn't horrible. So, like, probably nothing bad is going to happen because I'm not saying something that's, like, terrible and lamentable. But the truth is all of us make mistakes, Valerie, and at any moment the public could come for you and destroy your reputation. What was the question?
I have a huge problem. We're going to get back to you, Valerie, I promise. But I have a problem where, like, if I post something, like, even a little bit controversial, I have to check, like, 5 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour, like, to make sure that I didn't do something super wrong or that I'm not.
Right, or that something that you wrote wasn't taken out of context, or that it wasn't hurtful in a way that you didn't anticipate.
Right. Yes. Yeah, and, like, that's a lot of work for a freaking tweet. Anyway.
I mean, the internet has become, I think, for most of us, a place that does not relieve anxiety necessarily.
That's for sure.
But back to Valerie's question.
Yeah, I think it's really easy to be anxious about something that you aren't doing yet. The worst part for me of any time I'm gonna perform is sitting backstage waiting to perform, and that's where you're at right now, and that's where a lot of people were at until just now, basically. So it's very likely that Valerie's at school now. But that like not knowing how it's going to be and imagining all the ways that it could go wrong, that is in part like your brain preparing you for a new experience, but it's also like you can't control it. And so it's just unpleasant. Focusing on achievable objectives that are like, okay, well, I'm going to go to school. Here's something I can do to make myself a better person in the meantime, or like once you are there, you're still going to be feeling this, but in different ways. There's always this sort of like the next thing that you're worrying about. But focusing on sort of like how you are growing and how you have grown and giving a little bit of look back at like how much more effective and intelligent and knowledgeable you are than you were, you know, 4 years ago, which is, you know, has been probably a pretty big time of change for you, I'm guessing, if you're an incoming freshman.
Yeah, or if you're anybody else, really. I mean, four years should represent a significant amount of change, even to a 40-year-old man. By the way, thanks for the birthday wishes, Hank. I'm just kidding. You didn't wish me a happy birthday.
I called you on the phone, and I wished you a happy birthday.
I meant on today's podcast. Oh. I want birthday wishes all month long.
Happy birthday, John. I know it was your birthday however Thank long you. Ago that was forever ago. Get
it was
over
quite
it,
a while ago.
You old man.
Quite a while ago. Hank, I've got a question for you. It comes from Jackie and Josh, who write, "Dear John and Hank, as we're sitting on our back porch enjoying a fire on this chilly August evening at 64 in the suburbs of Chicago, my fiance Josh and I are wondering, does fire have mass? It seems to be weightless as you're watching it. Is it even possible to measure the mass of something that's so volatile? Flamio Hotman, Jackie and Josh."
Does that just mean like catch on fire, attractive men?
I believe it does. Yeah, I think that's the technical Latin.
Flamio Hotman. It depends on what you mean. Like there's a lot of conversations about what fire is, or like what's fire made of, and that's like so. There is, in a way, fire is a chemical reaction. And in that way, it doesn't have mass because it's not really a thing. It's an activity. It's like running doesn't have mass. It just is it's a verb. So in that way, not really. But like fire is made up of particles and those particles and energy. And both particles and energy have mass, or have mass equivalents. So Yeah, the stuff that you're seeing for the most part is like glowing smoke. Smoke that is so hot that it's glowing. And
really?
For one way or another, for one reason or another. And it's complicated.
Is this like pythons giving live birth?
I'm pretty sure
I'll never trust.
Right.
I can't trust you ever again.
I'm pretty sure that this is right. That like there's little particles of smoke and they are so hot and they are so energized that they are producing light in various ways, and the ways in which they are producing light are, I think, pretty complicated, but I don't know. But they are particles. And so those things, and currently why they're going upward is because they are surrounded by very hot gas that has been heated up in the fire, and that gas is moving upward and it's carrying those particles with it. And as cold air sort of rushes into the fire, that hot air is hotter and it's less dense, and so it's moving up because colder, more dense air is being pushed underneath it. So gravity is the reason why fire goes up, and when there's no gravity, fire doesn't go up, and you can actually see videos of fire on the space station, and it forms a sphere, which is weird.
That seems like a dangerous game to light a fire on the space station.
They control it pretty well. They have little fire boxes.
I would hope so. Hey, Hank, slightly off topic. Mm-hmm. Did you know that you can actually eat python eggs, the eggs that you didn't think existed? They're about twice the size of a chicken egg, and
wow.
They have more yolk in proportion to white than a chicken egg does, and a stronger, richer taste. But other than that, there's not much difference. People love eating python eggs. I'm looking at some python egg recipes right now.
Wow. I mean, how often do pythons lay eggs, and can you just farm pythons for eggs? You don't know the answer. Why?
No, as far as I can tell, Hank, people only raise pythons to eventually release them into the Everglades to create a non-native invasive species that can go to war with alligators. That's my understanding.
That's good.
This one comes from the siblings Crowell, who write, "Dear John and Hank, recently my sister and I went to our local hipster mall." What?
What?
I'm sorry.
There's a hipster mall?
What?
Do you shop for hipsters?
Yeah, I'm surprised to learn that there is such a thing as a hipster mall. The malls near me still all have Spencer gifts inside of them. To our local hipster mall to catch a screening of Rushmore. Even more surprising.
Wow, yeah.
Both of us have been longtime listeners of the pod, and we both thought the recommendation of the film was too great to pass up. We enjoyed the film thoroughly, but found ourselves in profound anticipation of the quote, "I ain't even here, Sergeant. I'm in Cheyenne, Wyoming." Much to our surprise, it wasn't even a quintessential instance in the movie as a whole. While we have since made peace with being misled with what we thought was the most iconic quote in Rushmore, how could one make peace with being misled by those we look up
to?
Che Cavolo Ste Facendo, the siblings Crowell. I hope you guys didn't just make me curse in Latin.
How did you mislead people? You said there was a quote in a movie, and
the
then there was a quote
in
a movie.
To me, the whole thing that makes Rushmore great is that many of the best lines are not presented with like, "and now we will cut the music so that the character can say a line and then like CSI Miami style put their sunglasses on." Like, I love that there are so many great little lines in that movie that you might not even notice till your second or third viewing. I apologize if I made it seem like it's a critical moment in the movie. It's not. Like, it's a play within a play moment, but I love that line. So I can't really apologize because I'm not really sorry, because I think that's what makes Rushmore so great, but it does have some other great lines for sure. And don't worry, the next time that I'm working on a book, I'm sure that I will quote all of them to Hank while we are potting.
I really need to watch this Rushmore movie, John. I assume that it is about the president's murder mystery.
Oh my God. Okay, so there's the most amazing thing in the movie. I think I've even told you this before. The most amazing thing in the movie happens very early on, where the Bill Murray character says to Max Fisher, "What's the secret, Max?" And Max says, "The secret?" And Bloom says, "Yeah, you seem to have it pretty figured out." And Max says, "The secret? I don't know. I guess you've just got to find something you love to do and then do it for the rest of your life. For me, it's going to Rushmore." And like the idea that like Max Fisher has figured out his passion, but it's going to this one particular high school it's just perfect.
Okay. That does sound good. I would like to have a passion. I have many. I would like to have a particular passion.
Oh, my God. What would I give Hank to have one passion?
What would that even be like? I sometimes see, like, people who just tweet about one thing, and I'm like, you person who loves this one particular weather satellite, how do I be you? How do I just love
I mean,
that?
I wonder if those people in real life, though, like on a day-to-day basis, if they're always thinking about that one particular weather satellite or weather satellites in general, or if like they also have lots of other interests, they don't share those interests with the public.
Mm-hmm.
I would like for you to have one driving public-facing interest so that I wouldn't have to have so many jobs being the tail to your many comets.
Could my like one public-facing interest just be going on Jamaican holiday?
Oh God, that's so obviously the phrase.
No, it's not. That was so good.
Nobody knew.
Everybody
it
forgot.
It wasn't even close.
Everybody forgot there was even a phrase of the week. They didn't even remember that it existed.
The only way they didn't know that was the phrase of the week is if they had forgotten that there is a phrase of the week bit that we're doing for a little bit to see if it works, which it probably isn't. We had a phrase of the week, which is Jamaican holiday, but Hank wedged it in there with all of the subtlety of like Donald Trump getting 8/10 of the way through a speech and realizing he hasn't said anything about building the wall.
I felt good about it.
I think that it's a definite loss. I think it's a definite win for me. But that said, today's podcast is brought to you by Jamaican holidays. Jamaican holidays. I actually don't think Hank has ever been on one, but Sarah and I go on one every year.
Oh, my. I didn't know that. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Hot Dog Bun Butts. Get yourself a 4-pack. Put your finger right down in the middle and say, that's how they do it. Hot Dog Bun Butts.
And today's podcast is additionally brought to you by the Sphere of Fire on the International Space Station. Yet one more reason not to be an astronaut.
And finally, this podcast is brought to you by Python Eggs. Hot, fresh, and tasty. Available at your local Python Egg Eatery. Special for your favorite Jamaican holidays.
Let's get back to questions from our listeners. This one comes from Laura, and I think you're going to love it, Hank, because it gets into something deep, ominous, dark, and deadly. Dear John and Hank, here's the thing. So a mermaid is half fish and half human, right? What do mermaids eat? I know that fish often eat other fish, and that's completely acceptable. But as someone who is half fish and half human, would the thinking and feeling human part of a mermaid feel cannibalistic eating a fish? If a mermaid does feel cannibalistic eating fish, and assuming they have fish friends like Ariel does in Little Mermaid, then would said mermaid be disgusted at their fish friends for eating fish? Additionally, would a mermaid be able to survive, get enough protein, etc., on a vegetarian-type diet with what they have available in the ocean? Do you think that a mermaid considers shellfish such as clams and mussels to be part of her own species, or distinguishes these as edible food sources without guilt? Hank, there are many good questions within this question to unpack, but to me the critical one is, do we make a distinction between species and like order or class or genus when it comes to cannibalism? In short, Hank, was it cannibalism for humans of the Homo sapien species to eat Neanderthals of the other human species? Is that cannibalism if you eat a different species of humans? Because Neanderthals and Homo sapiens did coexist. Would it have been cannibalism to eat them?
I mean, so I'm answering this question, but before I do, I gotta say that fish are not as closely related as we are with Neanderthals. Like, there are lots of fish that are much more distantly related than that. So there are a lot of fish. Especially when you're talking about shellfish, which aren't even fish. They're mollusks.
Right.
So that's
right.
A totally different thing. But anyway.
But like, can a clownfish eat a parrotfish, or are they too tight?
Well, I don't think either of those fish eat fish, but...
Well, hypothetically, Hank, hypothetically,
well,
can
like
a clownfish
like, yeah,
eat
like,
a...
My, like, can a shark eat a shark? Can a great white shark eat a hammerhead shark and be like, no big? And I think yes. I think absolutely yes. No big.
But all right, member of the Homo sapiens species eat a member of the Neanderthal species and not have it be cannibalism?
I think it's not cannibalism, but I still think it's really wrong. Mostly
well,
just the
killing. It definitely happened. Cannibalism was super common for almost all of human history.
Oh, yeah. No, I think
it's wrong.
I think mostly the killing is wrong. Like if you come across a dead Neanderthal, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It gives me the willies, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I've got the willies.
Yeah. I don't think it's wrong, Laura. I think that you can eat whatever you want to eat as long as you don't kill it. And if you're going to eat something that did get killed in order for you to eat it, then you should be emotionally and morally ready to have killed that thing. That's basically what I think.
But I will say that I think it wouldn't be a problem for a mermaid to be a vegetarian. Like, I think that they could pull that off.
Oh, there's so much seaweed. And the seaweed is very, it's high in protein. Seaweed's got everything in it.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Got kelp. But I do a little worry about, like, how do you cook underwater? Because that you're definitely everything is sushi if you're going to be a mermaid. Because you like,
and everybody likes sushi, but nobody wants sushi all the time.
No, just take it down to one of those deep sea vents where it's hot and weird, and cook it. Just hold it over the vent.
I mean, this is a very adventurous hypothetical mermaid that we've got. I mean, the good news is that there are no mermaids. Wait, God, I'll tell you what. If my daughter does listen to this, she's going to be devastated.
Does Alice think there are mermaids?
Alice is so funny. The only things that she believes in are leprechauns, which she believes are real in Ireland, no matter how many times I tell her that they are made up and that they are definitely not real. But she'll be like, dragons were never real, Daddy. And I'll be like, that's right. And she'll be like, unicorns are not real. And I'm like, that's right, Alice. And she'll be like, but leprechauns are real. And I'm like, no, they aren't. And she's like, they are in Ireland. And I'm like, no, they're not in Ireland. They're not real anywhere. And then she'll say, and mermaids are real. And I'll be like, yeah. And she'll be like, but very rare.
Well, what are we to tell her different?
I mean,
I don't even know where
at some point we're gonna have
pythons come from.
Did you ever listen to that episode of This American Life where the poor kid whose parents had never quite broken the news about unicorns was at a college party and they were discussing endangered animals and the effects that humans have had on biological diversity? God. And she asked, are unicorns extinct or just endangered? Maybe the best advice that we can give that young person who's headed off to college is that unicorns were never real. So now you're totally ready for your first year of university.
Yeah. Well, now also is there like a special label on iTunes for like Alice can't listen to this one?
Yeah.
It's like the E,
six
except
and up.
It's just an A. It's just like no Alice's. Because...
Hank, before we get to the news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon, we have a couple more things to mention. Mm-hmm. Most importantly, I need to give you an update. You might remember Clara. Remember?
Yeah.
Clara, who lost her vitally important shared journal on the Greyhound bus.
Mm-hmm.
Clara, whose name I was convinced was Clara. I misread the question. Her name was Clara. So I want to first apologize to Clara. Secondly, she wrote in to say, dear John and Hank, thank you so much for answering my question. I was ecstatic when I heard it. I wanted to let you know that we found the notebook. Also, I wanted to let you know that John's advice was helpful because I found it in my room.
Clara! Come on!
Clara. Clara, you got to look in your room before you call Greyhound.
Or dear Hank and John!
No, that's the definitely contact your friendly local advice podcast before you call anybody else. We also
good
got
job,
some name
John.
Specific sign offs that I want to read, Hank.
Yeah,
we got a great one from Kat, who signs her emails off "Curiosity hasn't killed me yet." Kat. We got a great one from Tyson, who signs off his emails of Tyson Men.
I really like this one from Mary, who signs off, eat, drink, and be Mary.
Oh, it's great.
Great.
It's gold.
It's so good because it works both ways.
And someone wrote in that their mother has an amazingly British name specific sign off, the crown, comma, jewels. I also want to thank Alex for sending in a couple suggestions for my daughter, Alice, when she's old enough to be writing emails. I very much like the sign-off with love or malice. This one's from Alice.
Good, good, good. Not allowed at the Vatican Palace, Alice. What did Alice do?
That's probably also going to be true. Hank, is there any way that I could go first? Because I have incredible news. I have the most exciting news that you could possibly imagine.
Did you score a point?
We scored, Hank, in the last two games, AFC Wimbledon scored, wait for it, 6 goals.
Goals are possible. They were just saving
them up. Goals are us. After scoring 1 goal in the first 3 games of the season, just kidding, the first 4 games of the season, and no goals in the previous like 6 games of last season, AFC Wimbledon scored 2 goals against Doncaster Rovers to win their first league game. Before that, someone on Twitter had sent me a very mean message. What's the difference between AFC Wimbledon and a triangle? A triangle has 3 points. And that was very mean. And I just want to say that that was mean. But you know what? Now AFC Wimbledon has 4 points. 4 league points.
That's
pretty much all you need to stay up. A critical win against Doncaster Rovers. And I'm really excited about it. It means that AFC Wimbledon are now well out of the relegation places by 1 point. yeah. Right where we need to be. 4 points after 4 games. And then last night, as we're recording this, the Dons played in the all-important Czechotrade Football League Trophy, which is one of these, like, you know, it's one of the, like, cup games that isn't about the league. It's like a different competition where all the teams in England play each other. And AFC Wimbledon started a team that can only be described as pretty much all children. In many cases, literally. In many cases, some literal children played, but they played very, very well. They scored 4 goals and won 4-3. Goal scorers included Egli Kaja, Ant Hardigan, who is 17 years old and just signed a professional contract, and Cody McDonald. So very exciting to see the young players from Wimbledon get a chance to play and to play so well. 4-3 victory, 2-0 victory, 2 wins on the trot. The Dons are going up, Hank. Next season, the championship.
All right. Or this season. You just got to win more.
Yeah, we just have to win a lot. Yeah,
gotta win a whole lot. John, you know what a big problem about going to Mars is?
Is it that the fuel weighs so much and you need to like extra fuel to push the fuel that weighs so much?
That is one of the big ones. But a lesser known one is that omega-3 fatty acids are essential oils that, not in the meaning of essential oil that you have heard of, but essential meaning that we can't make them ourselves, but our body needs them, so we have to eat them. And they actually break down over time. They are not stable, and if you try to just put them in a pill, eventually they turn into other stuff. And so basically, the scientists are like, we need to bring something with us that can make these things, and also in general. When you're going to Mars, you want to save every atom and turn it into something useful. And so that means like when you're peeing, like that pee, you're going to take all the water out of it and you're going to drink that water again. But then you're going to be left with some other stuff, a lot of urea, for example. You want to use that. You want to turn it into something useful. Well, some new research has taken that urea and combining it with carbon dioxide, which is, you know, we exhale it, but it's also, there's lots of it on Mars. And a yeast, as well as a cyanobacteria, which all together can turn urea and carbon dioxide into two different things. One, omega-3 fatty acids, which you could then eat and be like, this is delicious, and I sprinkled it on my toast this morning, or spread it on my toast, I guess. And the other, like basically polyester, so that you can use that to, you know, it's just a plastic that you can use in like a 3D printer to turn into, you know, whatever the 3D printer needs to make. So this research was presented by Clemson University's Mark Blenner, associate professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering. And the hope is that in the future, because right now, like, it sort of all gets like tied up inside of the yeast, inside of this little fungi, like one-celled fungi thing, that not only will we be able to sort of like get those yeasts to leave it behind in some way that we can get it without having to kill them, but also that we could potentially engineer them to be making very specific molecules. And that would allow us to create better plastics that would be more useful and also better stuff for eating. So yeah, all the we needed some of the nitrogen urea to help make the some of those things. And
great.
Now that's happening. So yeah, you can watch a video about it. That's on the. It's produced by PBS Digital Studios on the Reactions channel. There's pictures of urine sample vials. There's no one peeing.
Oh boy. I mean, that is like nothing has ever made me want to not go to Mars quite like knowing that I'm going to get my omega 3 fatty acids from the part of my pee that I'm not drinking.
Did you know, John, that on the International Space Station, the U.S. side of the space station has a urine recycler, and so they take their urine and they go through a whole process and then they drink it. But on the Russia side of the space station, they don't have one of those. So what do you think they do?
Do they just shoot it out into space?
No, John. They put it in a giant bag and they bring it over to the U.S. side of the space station and put it into our machine.
Oh man, space, the final frontier in so many ways.
Oh, space, what are we gonna do with all this pee?
Hank, what did we learn today?
John, we learned that mama python and hatchling do kiss waggling round, and you shouldn't burn books.
And we also learned that hot dog buns have butts that get cut somehow.
We learned that UPS takes 90% right-hand turns, and that Eileen Cooper takes 0% right-hand turns, because she'll just take the train, thank you very much.
Left-hand turns. It just doesn't take any left-hand turns, to be clear.
That's very confusing.
And lastly, we learned that Hank does not have one passion, but it would be nice for his brother if he did.
Yeah.
Hank, thank you for podding with me. We're off now to record This Week in Ryan's, our special podcast that we do every week where we talk about Orion, who lately hasn't been named Ryan, over at patreon.com/DearHankAndJohn. You can find out more over there if you want to join in on This Week in Ryan's, the worst 8 minutes of your week.
Dear Hank and John is produced by Rosianna Hulse-Rojas and Sheridan Gibson. Our community manager is Victoria Bongiorno. It's edited by Nicholas Jenkins. Our music is by the great Gunnarola. You can email us at hankandjohn@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter, Hank Green and John Green. Easy enough. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.